Yippee-yay, there'll be no wedding bells for today.
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle, as I go riding merrily along. And they sing, oh, ain't you glad you're single? And that song ain't so very far from wrong. Oh, Lily Bell,
Lily Bell,
oh, Lily Bell, Lily Bell.
I'm Robert Sickles, and I'm here with Kenda Kiefel and special guest star Zach Bentz in the basement of Hunter Conservatory, surrounded on all sides by heavy construction.
This is the cold open number 48.
The You Can't Wake Up If You Don't Go to Sleep Asteroid City edition. And we are here to talk about Wes Anderson's most recent film, Asteroid City, which we have all seen and we've got a lot of thoughts on. So, Zach, we'll start with you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's super nice to have you. And you have a long-time vested interest and passion for Wes Anderson, so we thought it'd be great to have you join us in our conversation. So tell us about your initial feelings in response to this film.
Yeah, I think so. It totally wasn't what I was expecting. And I think, it was, and it also wasn't. Like, it was the simultaneously one of the most quintessentially Wes Anderson things that I've seen, but also felt like nothing I've ever seen before. And I think a lot of that was because of the choice, like, not to include any of the, like, play, the, like, meta play elements in any of the advertising, which I think was, like, brilliant. I loved it. It was the most, like, emotionally invested that I've been in a Wes Anderson movie since Grand Budapest, I think. Not to say that I didn't love The French Dispatch, because I did. And I loved Isle of Dogs too, but it was like, I don't know. It was something about having that, like, that small contained story where instead of shifting back and forth between a lot of different people, it's like, this is a core group that's all experiencing the same thing together. Which I think made for a lot more of an emotional anchor for me, which had been missing a little bit in French Dispatch.
Absolutely. I love how you said that, and you're exactly right. It was ensemble in a different way, and Anderson does ensemble so well, but I love the focus of this. I agree too that it was the emotional investment piece is exactly, I was so excited to be so immersed. I felt like it was, yeah, quintessentially Wes Anderson, as you said, but also I could see how he, what he was doing as far as moves to experiment a little or try something new. And it's cool to see an artist such as him still evolving. And I was surprised several times over and delighted to be so just in the choices that he made, including that framing choice, like you said, of the black and white sort of television introduction with Bryan Cranston. And I loved the devices that are sort of his style, but also felt like speaking to the timelessness and the experiment of time and space that this story is. I also felt like he was paying tribute not only to both theater and cinema, but also like deep ancient theater, as in the three fates in the triplets and the Greek chorus in the parents that are, you know, chattering about the meaning of all of this, and the way that it was focused and a meditation on distance, time, and the layers therein was brilliant. So I have lots more to say, but Robert, I'd love to hear your initial.
It's so funny because my response, I did like the film overall, but my problem with it is what you guys liked most about it. I didn't feel connected to the characters, and I did not have those moments of emotional connection. When I think of Wes Anderson at his best, I think of Richie and Margot Tenenbaum in The Tent. Mm-hmm. I think of Harold Bloom finding out that Max Fisher's father is a barber. Like, that's one of my favorite moments.
So
I think
good.
Of Fantastic Mr. Fox and Mrs. Fox in front of the waterfall, like discussing their relationship and their marriage and some of those moments between Susie Bishop and Sam. I just didn't have any of those moments where I felt the characters were connected in a way that dialed me in on an emotional level. And I was pretty frustrated by that. And I was frustrated in part because of the structure I did not care for the structure in a way that I have in the past. It is the most Wes Anderson of Wes Anderson films, although you could say that about French Dispatch. Well, but that Russian doll structure that worked so well in Grand Budapest Hotel, I didn't feel worked as well in this. And while I liked elements of, I like the idea of like a 1950s era TV play, and I like the idea of the pre-production, right? When we're doing the casting, etc. And then I liked the surrealist interpretation of this is the play, the full color version, but I didn't think they meshed. I didn't buy the connection between them. It felt forced to me. And I found myself wanting to watch the color Asteroid City. Like, yes. That's where I was happiest, even though there were moments I quite liked in the black and white alternate worlds.
Yeah.
That it was the Asteroid City candy colored, outdoor, sun-drenched, like super overexposed. I just wanted to live in that world the entirety of the time. I don't know why we needed that extraneous framing device that he's so obsessed with that seems to happen. Even in movies that don't appear to have a framing device, they often do, like the opening of a book in Fantastic Mr. Fox, et cetera. So I was frustrated by that.
I know what you mean as far as being pulled out of the immersion, the delicious world of the super color. It was hard to contemplate that these were actors cast and recast, because I am immediately in and buy in. And it is, I felt like he was almost offering a critique on himself in a way, that that layer of artifice, I guess, because I agree with you on that front, where it was hard to pull back out to the black and white world. And I don't know if that was like a social experiment or not, but it was a little painful, because I feel like the meditation of the inner space of the super colorful desert is what a great piece of art does. We believe it in its entirety, and we believe it immediately. And I wanted to live there too. So I appreciate what you're saying, Robert. Would you speak more about those layers?
Yeah, I think the reason that it worked so well for me is because, like, so with Grand Budapest, I feel like the concentric framing device, it kind of gives Wes Anderson's style like a reason to exist narratively. Whereas, like, I don't know, in a film like Moonrise Kingdom, which was, I mean, has been my favorite Wes Anderson for years. But like, I mean, you could argue that like maybe it's because it's from the perspective of children, but you could argue that like the Wes Andersonness is like not integral to the plot. Like it's a stylistic decision. But with Grand Budapest, I feel like, because it's like a story told to another person who's telling it to another person who's telling it to another person, it's like the whimsy and the color and the strangeness of it all, and like the stylized dialogue and everything, it has like a narrative reason to exist, because it's like a version of a story that has reached through all of these different people through like this game of telephone. Mm-hmm. And this is like the version of it that's at the center of all of the layers. And I feel like with this, it does a similar thing, where it's like the color segments are like, it's like, that's just a Wes Anderson movie. It's just like a perfect, great, wonderful, enjoyable Wes Anderson movie. But then it's like, by introducing the meta play element, it's like, it gives all of that stylization and the narrative reason to exist, at least for me. And I think it also, I don't know, it's really interesting, because it kind of feels like a, I don't know, this might be a bit of a stretch, but it kind of feels like, in the like broader context of like the Wes Anderson aesthetic trend that's arisen, where it's people are just like taking that aesthetic at face value and trying to slap it on anything.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a really interesting deconstruction of like Wes Anderson making Wes Anderson movies, because it's like, okay, I'm going to prove why there is a reason for all of this to exist, and why I wouldn't be doing what I do if it weren't for this really specific style that I've spent my entire career developing. And so I think looking at the characters in the Wes Anderson movie portion as like extensions of other Wes Anderson characters is, I don't know, I think there's a really rich layer of like self-reflection there.
His style is his style. Our mutual friend Sienna Ack said a couple months ago that she had read an interview in which Wes Anderson was asked why he keeps making films the way he does. And he said his style is like his handwriting. And I thought that was a really kind of wonderful way to put it. You write like you write. So why would you try to write differently? That said, maybe there's a point at which the style becomes too much. And I'm less concerned about the visuals, which I adore in this film. I felt like it was overstuffed. Like, when you think about the cast, and I'm just going to name a few of them, Jason Schwartzman, Scarlett Johansson, Bryan Cranston, Ed Norton, Tom Hanks, Hope Davis, Liam Schreiber, Matt Dillon, Tilda Swinton, Fisher Stevens, Bob Balaban, Margot Robbie, like yes. Jeff Goldblum, like Adrian Brody, Hong Chow, Steve Carell. Like there's, it's so stuffed full of well-known kind of notable actors. And they're all known, but they're not all movie stars per se, but they're all recognizable. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think you can have that many characters without underutilizing almost all of them. And for me, that's what this film did, and I particularly would have liked to have seen more between the dual relationships of Scarlett Johansson as Midge Gamble and her daughter Dina, and Jason Schwartzman's Augie Steenback and his son Woodrow. Even though like they were arguably the focal point of the film, I would have liked even more focus on those characters. And even though I think it's fair to say, like, he's a director that specializes in ensemble. In his best movies, I would argue, though they're ensemble, there's still a focus on a couple of characters. So in Rushmore, it's Max, Harold, and Rosemary Cross, for example. In Moonrise Kingdom, it is Susie and Sam. And in Grand Budapest Hotel, it's Zero and Gustav M. And while there's still these large casts, the other characters are in the service to that main story.
Totally.
And I just didn't feel it that way. I felt it was really scattered, which didn't mean I didn't like the individual moments.
Sure.
I just don't think they added up as well as they do in other Wes Anderson films. With the caveat being, I thought the same thing about The French Dispatch, which I now like much, much, much more than I did. And I do think this is a film that not only would benefit from, but almost requires repeated viewing. So we'll see. You know, I've only seen it once. It's pretty fresh in my mind, but let's see what happens after a year. And I've seen it 5 or 6 times and had a chance to live with it. But this is definitely my initial impression. It put me off. But again, so too did French Dispatch, which I now love.
Yes.
Yeah, I had the exact same arc with French Dispatch, where I thought it was fine the first time I saw it, but like I've seen it like 5 times at least now, and I mean it's right up there with the best now for me of his. But I definitely do agree, as much as I like did adore and love, and I'm fully satisfied with what the final product of this movie was. I was surprised that they wrapped up the element of Augie not telling his children about his wife dying so early, because I remember when I picked up on that in the trailer, I think I expected and also kind of hoped that that would be like a conflict throughout the entire thing,
yes.
where like they would be experienced. And I think that that would have been a great way to like have it be a bit more focused on like this much smaller group of characters, and have, you know, the peripheral characters be in service of that, where it's like they're experiencing these like crazy life-changing events, and like against all of that, he's like trying to find the right moment to tell his children that their mom died. And I feel like that would have been a great emotional hook that would have centered it on like one specific conflict that is small but feels massive. And that, you know, all of the other characters, because of their like level of knowledge of the situation and our dramatic irony, would have like made for a better, I think, emotional through line.
So with that in mind, I really thought Tom Hanks was great. But really underutilized.
Yeah.
Yes.
But had they done that story, and I mean, you can't judge on what you would have liked them to have done, right? You got to judge them on what they did.
Yeah.
That said, had that been carried out further, I would have liked to have seen more of Tom Hanks. And I had liked the rapport between Jason Schwartzman. It was really fun and enjoyable. And I just would have liked to have seen more of it. And he's matured into this, like, Tom Hanks is a stone cold killer. He's just great.
Yeah.
In whatever he does.
Yes.
He has this,
and you're always happy to see him. Always.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. He's like, I mean, Denzel's the same way, although Denzel is not doing these kinds of movies that Hanks is a little more risk-taking.
I wish he would.
Me too.
Me too. I agree, though. I wish that had been mined more, because I do think it felt like it was supposed to be a central piece, because I felt like there was even the beautiful visual metaphor of them carrying the ashes and the small meteorite having blown this huge hole that everyone's sitting in. Like, that's grief, right? That's death. That's the contemplation they're supposed to be sitting in. I wanted a little bit more of that, especially through Woodrow. Like, I appreciated his sort of quiet sadness, but he only spoke to it really a couple of times. And I kind of thought, because I feel like Wes Anderson's so good at rhythm, like, I thought that he was going to carry the rhythm of that revelation a little further than it did feel like, so short and so almost resolved too easily early on. Just to speak quickly, though, to the rhythm of, and to Woodrow specifically, I loved specifically that part where they're playing the name game and we are sitting in the circle. So it's like, this could, I was, as we were sitting in that circle with them, it was like, this with a less masterful hand would be boring or go on too long and not be done right. And I felt like he did it exactly right, the way, the amount of time we sit with those kids, the way it's filmed and framed was so specifically excellent. And it spoke to that young adult piece of it, where you play a game, but you're happy to be sitting next to the person you like. And there's just this such a feeling to it that was so smart. And that felt like such a key scene, even though it's sort of silly, but also so beautiful. So just felt like that really exemplified his artful rhythmness of his style. So yeah, I love that scene.
Along those lines, I don't know what it is about Wes Anderson, but boy, does he get great performances out of kids.
God,
like,
yeah.
The kids are always so good in his films, and I thought this was no exception.
Yes.
And they brought like life and excitement and just a joy to the movie that was really fun. I forget the character's name, but Liam Schreiber's son.
Oh, love that kid.
Just great. It's so funny.
Do you dare me? It's so beautiful.
The moment where he has the, like, the vulnerable, this is why I do this, was definitely one of those, like, quintessential Wes Anderson moments where it's like, it hints at this, like, massive emotional truth.
Yes.
That, like, you get a glimpse of and you feel really intensely.
That was gorgeous. I agree.
So let's talk about that. We've definitely talked about the good and the bad, but let's talk about key moments. So if you had to choose, what were the moments that you most kind of liked in this film that you responded to? I had two, but we'll start with you, Kendra. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the moment I was most, this is maybe a cliched moment, but I did want to ask you both about the alien because of the choice. It was a key moment in that was when I was most surprised and delighted by the choice that Wes Anderson made that felt sort of unlike him and quintessentially him at the same time. I was delighted by the visual choice of that sort of stop motion length and movement and goofiness of that alien. Or just the alien landing to begin with. I didn't think that was even going to be part of this story. And I loved it in the way it connected to us learning that Jeff Goldblum is making choices and believing in this metaphor of the alien, even though we would have no idea at any point that it would be him, except when we see him speaking backstage. I loved that connection point and how surprising it was. Key moment, sorry, I was trying to think of my second one. A key moment to me in my deep love for those triplets was the arrival and sort of introduction of Augie's family. And when they're all sitting at the diner, I just felt, I felt character-wise, it was very hilarious and exciting for the waitress to call them all princesses and them being like, I'm not a princess, I'm a mummy from ancient Egypt. And this, like, it felt like him speaking to the complexity of childhood and these key characters, even though we don't get to hear those girls speak that much, that was a memorable, beautiful moment to me. So I don't know if it was key, but it was great. How about you, Zach?
I definitely also, the alien landing yes. scene was fantastic. I had known that there was going to be an alien plot in some way because of the trailer. And I looked at the credits and I had seen Jeff Goldblum credited as the extraterrestrial. And so I was dying to see what the like creative choice was going to be. And I was like, I had been like pondering over it for weeks before I saw it. And like genuinely nothing could have prepared me for what the end result actually was. But also it makes so much sense because it's like, that is a form that he has played with so much and that has become so synonymous with him. And also we saw in French Dispatch how he's like experimenting with blending live action with animation. And so this felt like the perfect culmination of that because it felt like so perfectly done. And you don't even really, like, even though you're aware of the fact that it's stop motion and that he's playing with a technique that he's used before, you really, at least for me, I didn't question the fact that this was like a physical creature that existed in this world once, because it totally felt like one.
Yes.
And I loved the design of it too. Like, yeah, it feels very goofy, but it also was like kind of chilling and kind of unsettling and uncanny.
Yeah, uncanny. It was lovely.
Which was like to see Wes Anderson create an image like that one was wild. And I feel like we're gonna start seeing like the shot of the alien and all of those like all-time great moments of cinema montages in a couple months once it comes out on home release. But I think also there are two others, but I'll if I have to pick one, I think the other big one was, I think, the moment between Jason Schwartzman's character, the actor, not Augie, but the actor, the moment between him and Conrad Erb after the audition, but just like that whole audition scene was like so beautiful. And I think that was the moment where I was 100% sold on the framing, because I was like, okay, now I like everything we see in quote unquote Asteroid City from now on is like, you see it as an extension of these people. Like you see them as people playing people. And by that, through that, I feel like we learn about the characters of the actors. And I think that's really interesting. And that I think that's one of the reasons the framing worked for me so well, is because you see you start looking for glimpses of these people who you've seen already seen little glimpses of showing up in these people that they're playing, that you're already invested in. And so you're trying to like reconcile these people who are the same, but who are different and who are trying to be one another. And I think that's really fascinating. Also the moment between, I'm gonna add a bonus one, but
please,
the moment between that same Jason Schwartzman character and Margot Robbie's character on the balconies.
I think that
felt like the emotional peak. And I think it's the reason that that was so impactful to me, I think, was because we don't get an emotional climax for Asteroid City. Like, we get an emotional climax. As soon as the emotional climax for Asteroid City is about to happen, we cut away and the emotional climax comes through the actors, which I think is also, you know, in service of that sense of, we're seeing these people live through their characters and we're learning about them through the characters that they're playing. But then they realize at that moment of emotional catharsis that they need to experience that through themselves instead of through their characters, which I think is great.
Beautiful. Can I say something to that really quickly? I love that part too. And the way he says, you're the wife that played my actress, right? He mixes up, and that enmeshed, yes, you're right, the becoming the characters and the character telling you what they need to be, that felt so stunning and integral. And that reminded me actually of what I felt like the movie Synecdoche, New York, and Charlie Kaufman was sort of speaking to in a different way, that like all of those, the realness, right, of the artifice. I love that you said that. And after you speak, I just want to add one more key moment, so go ahead, Robert.
I would argue that Asteroid City for me did have an emotional climax, and it was the burying of the ashes with the three little girls, who I also loved. I should note that they're named Andromeda, Pandora, and Cassiopeia.
That's right.
Which is kind of amazing. I don't know if they're triplets, but they're actually played by real sisters, Ella Grace and Willem Ferris.
Yes.
And they were kind of lovely in it. But that was the moment for me that wrapped up the Asteroid City story, but when I looked at this film, the moments that I liked the most, I loved it when Tilda Swinton's Dr. Hickenlooper told Woodrow that it doesn't matter whether you achieve this great scientific thing, that you still have value, that you still have meaning, that you don't have to, you don't have to necessarily accomplish something to have a life worth living, basically. And along those lines, I thought that was paralleled outside of Asteroid City when Adrian Brody, Schubert Green character, told Jason Schwartzman, who didn't understand when he put his hand on the waffle iron, that it doesn't matter if you don't understand the play. He said, just keep on telling the story. You don't need to understand it. You're doing great. Move forward. Like, it was really kind of wonderful. And I think Adrian Brody has secretly, like, reinvented himself as just an invaluable member of the Anderson entourage. Mm-hmm. Like, he was so good in French Dispatch and just wonderful in Grand Budapest Hotel. And he has become more of a... He always was a character actor, and though he won the Academy Award for The Piano, it kind of for a while thrust him into like movie stardom that he wasn't necessarily well suited for. But when he plays these supporting kind of secondary roles, he's absolutely wonderful. And there's something about his persona that particularly lends itself to Wes Anderson's films. And obviously he did that long ago in Darjeeling, but there was a long gap in between films, and he seems to be well suited for it. I would also argue the same thing about Ed Norton, who is an actor that I sure wish we saw more often, but I'm glad to see him in these fleeting moments in the Wes Anderson films. He has a way of doing that. But for me, those two moments were really kind of wonderful moments about just life is worth living on so many levels, and accomplishment does not define you or is not essential to happiness or meaningful existence. And that was profound. I did like that moment quite a bit.
Yeah, good one. That's fantastic. May it also, Tilda Swinton, no matter how much screen time she has, she is such a genius. Like, I loved her in this, and just she makes it count so hard, like the seconds that she's on the screen. And same even in French Dispatch as the sort of curator, art historian, like, but the her range is just insane to me. I love her so much. But can I add a bonus scene that I just thought was stunning very quickly? When we see Scarlett Johansson's character, in the bathtub with the pills and is practicing her suicide, and when Jason Schwartzman is talking to her, and there she asks to do the scene with him, and I thought that really evoked a lot in me, just in her saying, well, use your grief. Like, it, I feel like it's in a little tiny glimpse, it's sort of the one time or one of just a couple that we really see him break a tiny bit as far as him confronting or being emotional as far as what he's actually going through. And I just thought that was an incredible scene. And I loved it, especially when he's like, are you a ghost talking to, like, this contemplation of the stage direction within the life of the story and the play. I just feel like there were a few moments like that where they're using theater language and talking about just what your direction is. Just felt, I liked the meta-ness of that, but I just, that scene was emotional to me, and it really got me. So I loved that one too.
So let's change gears and go to 30,000 feet.
Okay.
Prior to seeing this film, I had seen, in order, Super Mario Brothers, Fast X, Little Mermaid, Guardians of the Galaxy, Across the Spider-Verse, and The Flash.
Nice.
And most of them weren't good. A couple of them were legitimately bad. But my point is I didn't necessarily see those because I wanted to, although I did want to see Across the Spider-Verse. But I saw them because I love movies and I love going to the theater, and that's what's there.
Yes.
There's just, we're so inundated with these sequels and IP, etc. And even those aren't doing as well as they once did, but they're certainly doing better than a movie like Asteroid City. We all saw Asteroid City in the same theater. opening night, and it's in the smallest fucking theater, like in a little tiny theater, and it was super sparsely attended. The good news is this movie made $9 million over opening weekend. It's the most of any Wes Anderson film. It broke his previous record of $8.5 million for Grand Budapest. But some of those movies had legs. Like Grand Budapest Hotel and Moonrise Kingdom both did quite well financially comparatively over time. I don't know that this movie will. It might be too weird. So that's the good news. Like, it's literally his highest grossing film, and I would at least opening weekend, and that has something to do with the cast, right? It's not going to get 170 million or whatever Grand Budapest got. It's just not going to. The bad news is the film cost $25 million.
Okay, that's my next question.
To make,
shoot,
it's going to have to make upwards. You know, if you go by the 3-to-1 rule, it's going to have to make upwards of $75 million to turn a profit. There is no fucking way this film is going to make that kind of money, which is like, it says so much about what's being made, why it's made, how it's being promoted, who it's being promoted to, and the expectations of audiences and the consequences of the pandemic, where I think people have a movie like Asteroid City screams, watch at home. It just does. And obviously, like, for us, it doesn't. It screams, watch in the movie theater, because we want to see what we love about Wes Anderson rock big. But I just don't think a lot of people, I think cinephilia is a minority, not a majority, obviously. So what do you all think when you think about what comes next for Wes Anderson and films like this that seemingly just continue to struggle, even when they're made at, in Hollywood parlance, like a pit, it's like just a pretty small production budget.
Right.
Well, from what I've been seeing, I think that this film is being advertised really, 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 really heavily to that cinephile population.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that they know their audience, at least the people who are like, you know, distributing and marketing this film. I think they know their audience really well, and I think that they know who to market to and they know who to push it to, because the majority of the advertising that I've seen for this film has actually been on social media, and it's been, you know, like Letterboxd has been, like, the people who run Letterboxd and who work for Letterboxd have been doing a lot with the cast. Like, there have been so many little clips of like the Letterboxd cast and crew interviewing Wes and interviewing all the cast, and there's all of the clips have this element of like all of the cast like totally knows who this is, and they're happy to talk to them, and they like, there's like this small community of people that like really, really, really loves this and wants to be a part of this. And I feel like that's really who they're pushing toward. And I feel like they're not trying to push very far outside of that. Because I feel like I've also seen a lot of headlines where it's like Scarlett Johansson's new movie, or like Bryan Cranston's new movie, and it's like there's no mention of this kind of like cult following that comes from this very specific corner of moviegoers and theatergoers. And so I think that Wes Anderson has carved out his niche really well, and I think that because of sentiments like his style is his handwriting, I don't think he's going to expand beyond that. And so I think that the people who are doing the distribution and marketing, I think that they know that. And I think that they know that they need to push the people that they do have in their pocket to go be a part of this. And that's the only way that it's going to keep happening.
He's Woody Allen.
Yeah.
He just is. Like, he is, as far as style, he has style. He has actors he uses over and over. Mm-hmm. He has similarity of story, tone, and intent.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just going to make it over and over and over again. While that allowed Woody Allen to make 50 plus films over a 50 plus year career, I just know that the industry is such that the cachet of having a critically acclaimed director making your film outweighs the profit motive.
Yeah.
I don't know that it ever did, but that was
the
deal. Like, Woody Allen's films made money, right? They would be made for cheaply enough for a large enough audience that was still very small by Hollywood standards, but large enough to continue to allow him to keep making films. And I don't necessarily think that Wes Anderson's not going to be able to keep making films, but I wonder about where. And so along those lines, his next film, which is actually coming out this fall, and he didn't make them that quickly. It's just French Dispatch got held up because of the pandemic. It is the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, and it's made for Netflix.
Oh.
And it is an adaptation of a Roald Dahl book, obviously the second one after Fantastic Mr. Fox. Netflix, in the IP wars, for lack of a better word, paid almost $700 million in 2021 for the Roald Dahl Story Company to kind of acquire the rights, which I don't know that includes Willy Wonka or not, because there's a Wonka film coming out this fall with Timothée Chalamet. It's a young Wonka, and that's how we found Oompa Loompas. But that's coming out through Warner Brothers, so that's different. But I wonder if Netflix might be a home for something like this. But it's got to be a different home. For a while, Netflix was giving directors carte blanche, like Martin Scorsese, to make The Irishman, you know, for in excess of $100 million, just for the prestige of having those directors. I think that the Wall Street's desire for the streaming companies to turn a profit precludes that. Like, just having that director on your roster for the prestige is not enough. But I wonder if there can be a home for the kinds of directors that we tend to love in the streaming world. Apple's obviously done this as well, but this is, a lot of these deals were signed pre, like, the Netflix catastrophe of last year. So I don't know. Like, I think that age of $100 million unlimited budgets for auteur directors is done, but maybe they can still find a home.
I hope so too. I had this question in my mind too. I was pleased that we weren't the only ones in the theater, because similarly, it's been quite quiet as far as this kind of a movie, this level of quality. I was so grateful that there were probably about, I don't know, 15 people in the theater that we were in, including my husband and two children. And what I was so stoked about in our viewing experience over the weekend was, we got one of the applause at the end moments with the 15 people that were in there. And I was like, oh, everyone here is going to go tell all of the people they know how awesome this is to see on the big screen. And so I was curious about, like, even though it is a small audience comparably, I can see this particularly being a word of mouth situation. But I had a similar thought, Robert, as far as that streaming and Netflix platform versus these semi-wide releases, and how necessary it obviously is to all of us that we see these on the large screen. But I do wonder about where his home will be, and also what the next move is for the big screen release, right, as far as style movie. Yeah.
It's a different release model in that his most successful films played for actually a fairly long period of time. They don't need to make 70% of their money on opening weekend. It doesn't work. So it is possible that this could play. When you look at our movie theater, which is a pretty representative movie theater, we've got 14 screens, and we've got like four movies in the movie theater, or five, and there's one screen for Asteroid City and one screen for No Hard Feelings, which is obviously a different intended audience, but it's still relatively small budget, et cetera, trying to attract something that's counterprogramming, right? We'll see. We'll see whether it has legs or not, that word of mouth. I do have a question for you. Zach, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I think the case of Henry Sugar is really interesting, because we were talking about, like, you know, playing to the niche. And I feel like Henry Sugar is going to be the most vastly different thing that Wes Anderson has ever done, because it's 37 minutes long and it's all shot on film on a stage. So it's just like, in terms of production and I don't know, but I assume visual style is going to be very different than everything he's ever done. And, like, formally, because it's basically a short film. And it kind of reminds me of Anima, the Paul Thomas Anderson short film that he did with Tom York, which I love. I've watched it like 20 times. It's one of my favorite things that either of them have ever done. But, you know, it's like an auteur director doing this weird, shorter side project that gets dumped on streaming, that, you know, in the case of Anima, I don't think anybody watched that. But, you know, I'm curious to see, you know, what the audience for Henry Sugar ultimately ends up being, because it's a really weird project. But yeah, I think, I mean, like, a place like Netflix is, I think, the only place that a film like Henry Sugar could realistically, you know, be released.
So the difficult part about this is we'll never know.
Yeah.
Right? Netflix will never release any sort of information that lets us know anything.
How?
Something like, I love A Very Merry Christmas, the Sofia Coppola thing, which literally could only have a home on Netflix.
Fair
enough. So it still plays. It's still on the net. It's still on the service. So maybe it has an audience. But I guess what gets made afterwards will give us some indication as to its success or lack thereof. Kinda, let me ask you, I took Dutch until a 19-year-old, just finished freshman year of college, and 16-year-old going into junior year of high school. Tallulah has literally seen every Wes Anderson film.
Nice.
And Wes Anderson, and Dutch had only seen two. He'd seen Isle of Dogs and Fantastic Mr. Fox, but they both really, really liked it. The caveat being they're weird kids. They're not weird, but they've been exposed to a lot of different films that maybe not all kids have been exposed to, but I just wondered, your kids are significantly younger.
Yeah.
What did they think? What did they feel?
Great question. Oh, I love hearing that. Your children are extraordinary. My son just turned 14 and my daughter's about to turn 10. So that's their range. They laughed very hard, and my 14-year-old was activated by this movie. He had so many great thoughts and questions. I was like quoting things. I was like, nostalgia for the present. That's awesome. But he really immediately was gesturing wildly and was like, wow, the way that, you know, the microphone is in front of the other microphone. I got the message so thoroughly as far as the poetry of Wes Anderson. And he's seen most of the films to speak to the backlog. Bella has not, although she did love Moonrise Kingdom, which is one of my favorites too. They both loved it, but I would say specifically my 14-year-old, it spoke to his soul. And I do think also just characters around his same age was exciting and interesting, especially strange kids in a strange place. Like all of that really, I think his fanship was solidified with Asteroid City. And Bella was a little quieter about it. She had funny parts, but she I think could take it or leave it a little bit. But we have not shown them Rushmore, which is the plan for this weekend, which we're going to start back at the front.
So kids are still open to Wednesday.
Yes.
They just are.
Yes, they are.
So there's something about that they just are open to it in a way a lot of adults are too cool to be exposed to, whimsy. So the critical reception of this, it's good but not great. It's more positive than not, but somewhat mixed. And critics like it more than audiences, which is not super surprising. But what I've really been struck by the criticism, which I did not, as is my law, I didn't read anything until I saw the movie, but I've read a ton afterwards. We've all got our go-tos we go to. What I would say that I was struck by in the reviews is the reviews were less about the movie and more about Wes Anderson. And it was literally, I like Wes Anderson, or I don't like Wes Anderson. And if you tend to like Wes Anderson, then you're going to like this film.
Mm-hmm.
And you refer to all these things in other films, how this is an extension and a continuance of those things and how you like where it's going. Whereas if you don't like him, you refer to all these other things that you didn't like in his other films and how this is just more of the same. So the criticism about him is so ridiculously, or the criticism about this film is so ridiculously auteurist-minded. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of really fun to read, because I was like, I don't know whether you like this movie or not, but I'm crystal clear on whether or not you like Wes Anderson.
Yes. Did you read any specifically interesting critiques back of, or heard even from your peers about what wasn't working or was for this
movie? I haven't read a lot since seeing the movie, actually. I've you know, perused Letterboxd, and I've seen a YouTube video or two, but I know that at least among the circles that, I tend to, consume my film criticism through, it's, very beloved. I had, heard a lot of not specifics, but a lot of just like general sentiments going into it. And you know, I was hearing folks say like, this is his best. Like this is either among his best or like this is his best ever. Mm-hmm. And I went in with high expectations and, you know, I was very satisfied. I don't agree that it's his best film ever at all. And you know, I don't know that I think that I would put it in his top five even, but maybe after some, I'm seeing it again tonight. So maybe after some repeats, it will do. It'll have the French Dispatch effect.
Nice.
I don't know if that would work for me seeing it so quickly, Zach. I'm kind of craving to see it again. I'm with you on that. But French Dispatch for me took time. Mm-hmm. It took time and kind of distance to come back to it. And I imagine this might have the same requirement for me. I think it is definitely a lesser Wes Anderson film. But I would also say, you know, go back to that list of films that I told you that I watch. I will take a film from Wes Anderson that I don't think is as good as his best film. But I don't know if I'd put it in the top 10. It's near the bottom for me. But God, I'll take that over fucking Fast X. Or like a Little Mermaid live action remake. Like just, The Flash, which was like, it had its moments, but it was just, it just seems like a lot of ideas and storytelling. And just, I feel like when I go to those movies, I'm increasingly just bludgeoned. Yes. I'm not asked to think. I'm not asked to respond. I'm not asked to feel. I'm just meant to absorb the punishment. And I might add that punishment is increasingly like 2 hours and 40 minutes, like two so hours long. And 45 yes. minutes. And yes. again, Wes Anderson, like neatly under 2 hours, he's quick, short, to the point, yes. and you're done. And he's actually trying to say something.
Yes, and ask something of you. It's generous and it's a dialogue rather than a monologue I would offer. It's a relief to see artistry still on the big screen between the Spider-Verse and this. I was like, well, thank goodness there are pieces that are still engaging with us in an intellectual and artistic way, because I agree there is a real gap as far as the audience getting credit for being anywhere near intelligent. So sounds good. So yes.
Okay. Well, I think we've discuss the shit out of this movie 50 minutes in. So I thank you both. That was really fun. So I'm Robert Sickles for Kinda Kiefel and special guest star Zach Bentz. And this has been
The Cold Open number 48.
As I walked out in the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day, I spied a young cowboy all wrapped in white linen as cold as the clay.